Our subject today is movies and movie stars. And who can tell us more about the great golden age of Hollywood than our special guest this afternoon? He's a man who has spent most of his life in and around the glamour capital of the world. A man whose career began in vaudeville and continued and flourished on the Broadway stage, in motion pictures, where he appeared on the screen and produced films for the screen, too, and for his own enjoyment. He's a man who starred on television and who is now starring between the covers of a brand new Doubleday book. We're speaking, of course, of Ken Murray, Movieland's great historian, keeper of the archives, and author of a beautiful new book about an amazing chapter in the legend of Hollywood. Ken Murray, welcome to Those Were the Days.
Well, I'm glad to be here, Chuck. I'm glad you invited me.
See, I spent a delightful time this week reading your book, The Golden Days of San Simeon. It's a great book. It's really terrific.
Thank you. Coming from a young man in his early 30s, I consider that a great compliment.
Oh, it's really a marvelous thing. And I know you've taken thousands of feet of film about that great spot, but of course, this is radio now. So how would you like to give our listeners a word picture of the castle, the San Simeon, and the man who built it?
Well, probably the best way I could describe it, I'm sure the best way I could describe it, is to tell you that it is the most magnificent private dwelling ever imagined by any uncrowned mortal on the North American continent. I think probably that's the only way that I could describe it. I'll tell you about it, what it contains, so that may give you a little bit. It has 38 bedrooms, 14 living rooms, sitting rooms, and 35 bathrooms. A total, and with the three guest houses, a total of 146 rooms in all. That's besides two swimming pools, one outdoors, one indoors, and a library and a refectory and an assembly hall and a movie theater, where incidentally some of my home movies that you mentioned are playing for the tourists. I put them in, gave them to Governor Reagan a year ago, Washington's birthday, and they've been playing in the theater for the tourists. They're on the regular tour for the last year and a half. We've placed over close to 700,000 people a year.
Wow. Now, this was the private home, so to speak, of William Randolph Hearst.
It was a dream. He was a dreamer, you know. Mm-hmm. He was a dreamer. You know, Chuck, interviewer the other day on the coast or Vancouver or somebody, he said something to me, and it made things a lot easier, and I'm going to mention it to you. And he said, Ken, you're the first biographer of Mr. Hearst that ever said anything nice about him. How come? You know? And I want to explain that why. You see, Mr. Hearst was one of the 10 most powerful Americans in the last 100 years. And a man has got to be many faceted to be one of the 10 most powerful men. Gonna make a lot of enemies, gonna make a lot of ruthless things to some people, it'll seem. But he also must have other sides to him. And nobody ever took the trouble, though they have mentioned it at times, but nobody ever took the trouble to really delve down. In the beginning of the book, if you remember, I said, I hope Mr. Hearst emerges from these pages as a human being.
He does.
That's the thing. I said, having accepted his hospitality, you see. So what I did is I took Hearst the host, and I did the story. It's the first book, you know, that's ever been done on the castle. Many books, about 200 books written on Mr. Hearst. But no one ever did it on the castle from the beginning. See, by putting the film in the castle, the state appointed me on a board called the California State Foundation. Mm-hmm. And I got access to pictures of the castle being built, which have never been printed before.
Which had become the property of the state.
Well, it is the property of the state, you see, yes. And they had and you notice in the book, we've got it, the mountain before there was anything on it, and then slowly shows you building it and the story of Julia Morgan, who would have been quite a woman's liberation figure at this time if she were alive. But here was a woman that started when she was 47 years old.
The architect.
Uh-huh. She was the one architect, and also the interior decorator. Mm-hmm. See, that's what some people don't realize.
She
I never
did
heard
both.
That. She did both. I contacted her niece, who was still alive, a nephew in Berkeley, and they told me, and she did both. But what I did is I did the whole story, but the emphasis on it comes out, I think you'll agree, the man had a dream, and he never fulfilled it, as I probably most dreams, I guess, are never fulfilled. I don't know. I feel some of mine is. When I met my wife and I married her and been married 22 years and two kids, I certainly think a great portion of my dreams have been fulfilled of having a happy wedded life, you know, with a family. But most dreams weren't. And he had what Mr. Hearst had what J.P. Marken called an Oedipus complex, had a compulsion to build. Mm-hmm. You see, he had many other dwellings, you know. He had a place in Wintoon, a beautiful place nestled in the near the Rogue River. I think the Rogue River ran right through almost with the living room. And Pogani did all these different houses, you know, the bear house and with the cartoons and things. And then he had a castle in Scotland called St. Donat's. He never spent much time there. But San Simeon was the fulfillment, really. He was carrying on the tradition of beauty and culture that his mother had instilled in him from the time he was 11 years old when she took him to Europe for the first time. Where, incidentally, he tried to buy Westminster Abbey.
He tried to buy it?
He tried to buy it. He said to his mother, you know, can't we buy that? I'd like to have it here. That's where he first got his idea, to. And he was a very big man in every way, 6'4". I had a very amusing experience when I met him the first time. I'll never forget. I was ever so embarrassed in my life. I didn't even put it in the book. Arthur Lake, a friend of mine, got to know the Hearst boys and ultimately married Marion Davies' niece, Pat Lake, and still married, have a family. And he was a friend of mine. He said, and he knew that I liked to take home movies from the early 20s. And he said, Kenny, you got to come up and meet the chief. He's a wonderful man. And well, the name of William Randolph Hearst in the late 20s and early 30s put chills in your down your spine, you know? Why, I can't tell you, but there's no one like that now. But he was a powerful man, very, very frightening. So anyway, I that wasn't the main reason I went up. But when he told me there were movie stars there that I could take and send home to my folks, like I was sending him home, I left the projector at home. So we got up there. We went to a California Stanford football game. We were all going, and on the way up, he arranged through the castle and Mr. Hearst for us to be allowed in the gate. It's a 5-mile drive from the road, you know, up to the castle. Had to go past the animals and all that. And we got there just about 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock, and upstairs in the cloister suite they had where they put the. He had a set of suites right on the second floor where most single men were put. And they were put double, you know. If it was a double room, double baths. I mean, everything went first class. So at 7:30, we were down, came downstairs to meet him. That was the only must for San Simeon, that you must be at 7:30 or you request you to have there. And he'd come down from his Gothic suite in an elevator, in his private elevator, which I showed you in the book.
Yes.
You know, I wrote in you it, wrote by the way, finally. Yeah. Then we have a little social hour, and then you go into the refectory and have a wonderful, wonderful meal, you know. Just anything. Fantastic. No restaurant could be better if it's good. And very few is good. And then go into the theater and see a movie. But anyway, when we got there at 7:30, the place was filled with people. It was a weekend. See, the football game was on Saturday. And the place was filled. And this beautiful room, this refectory, is 84 feet long. It's 30 feet wide, 32 feet wide, and 20 feet high. And it has all these priceless paintings and silverware, statues. And
we don't dare call it a dining room.
No, this is the assembly room.
The assembly.
This is where you met.
Oh, I see.
So I'm just telling you, that's where I met him.
Right,
then you go into the dining room.
I see.
That was
the refectory.
Yeah. So anyway, he had me by the arm like a little kid, you know, and we're winding our way. I remember Irving Cobb was there, the Shah of Iran was there, Gable and Grant and Cooper, and I'm mentioning people that you would know, and then a lot of faces not quite identified because they were executives of Mr. Hearst. So anyway, this place is jammed, and he pulls me up, and finally I'm standing in front of this big man, this tall man. Now, you try to imagine that during the 30s, I don't know whether I just got to know all smaller people, but I've always been 6'1", you know. I didn't meet many people that were taller than me.
Uh-huh.
I really didn't. It was an oddity if I met a person taller than me, because I even played basketball. I was a center, and fine. Now, where would I be now? I mean, a water boy or something, you know. And a 6'1" is ridiculous. So anyway, he got me over, and finally went in front of Mr. Hurst. Now, here, if you can imagine, this luscious place, this grand, magnificent room. And he said, "Mr. Hurst, I'd like you to meet my friend, Mr. Kent Murray." And Mr. Hurst said something, I don't remember what he said, but I said the stupidest thing. I said, "Mr. Hurst, you sure got a nice place here." But I'll say one thing. He was very, very gracious. And he said, "Well, I'm glad you like it. And we're going to have a little tour a little bit later. And if you'd like to come along with us, I'd show you." So he took us to, he loved to show off the place. And it wasn't any ego trip or anything. He was just proud of San Simeon. He wanted his guests to enjoy it to the full.
He wanted to share what he had.
He certainly
built,
did.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you, that's a very interesting point. When I was putting the film in that day, there were some young people there, 19, 20, 18, a group of them. And after the film, you see, they were so impressed. They came over to me and said, "You know, this is the only castle in the world." So we've been to Europe. And this is the only castle in the world where you can go in and see actual movies of the man who built the place. Living there and entertaining his friends, you see. And I said to him, I said, "You know, I'm quite surprised. Two things surprised me. First of all, that you're here, and second, that you like it." Because I thought, if one thing is certainly going to be gross establishment if I ever saw. So he said, no, we've been discussing, we're talking about it, and we don't feel that way at all. He said, many millionaires have more money than Hurst. But most of them, in fact, practically all of them, hand their fortunes down from generation to generation to their ancestors. And he said, "But Mr. Hurst enjoyed his wealth, shared it with his friends, and then left it for future generations to enjoy as he did."
That reminds me of a line in your book. In the introduction to the book, you say that this is the story of a man and his money, not how he made it, but how he spent it.
And shared it with his friends.
And that's really great.
That
is wonderful. And what did George Bernard Shaw say when he saw the castle?
Well, I wasn't there. Cary Grant told me this.
Uh-huh.
I mean, he went the first time that George Bernard Shaw saw San Simeon, he said that this is probably the way God would have done it if he'd had the money. And a wonderful line.
Beautiful, beautiful. We're going to talk more about the castle at San Simeon and the golden days of San Simeon and the golden days of Hollywood with Ken Murray, and we'll be back in just a little bit. Our guest today on Those Were the Days is Ken Murray, author of a beautiful new book about the golden days of San Simeon. And Hollywood and movie stars are the topic of conversation today on our weekly Saturday afternoon get-together. Ken Murray, what about William Randolph Hearst and his early days in the movies? He was a pioneer early in the game, wasn't he?
He certainly was. He had a great... Well, one of the things I liked about him, I'm sure that attracted me, is, you see, next year will be my 50th year in show business. My father was a comedian. And the fact that Mr. Hearst liked show business and show people so much, I think made me have an affection for him even more so than probably the average person, because he really did. He loved even home movies, you know. He loved to take home movies, and he loved to work in them, and he'd pose for you. Well, you know, in the book there, you got him kidding with that, and also in the theater up there, the film, he's kidding with Marie Dressler, and they're having a ball. But he started, he was always interested in photography, I guess, since the first box camera he got. And in the early days, he had the money to buy, and he got the newest lenses and everything, and he was interested. And then when the talkies came in, he got interested in that, as he was, and everything new and exciting. And he, actually, the things he did, for one thing, he had the first newsreel that was ever made, he made. And it was Woodrow Wilson's inauguration in 1913. Mm-hmm. And that was the beginning of the Hearst-Seelig newsreel. They brought it and put it in a theater in New York, and it was such a sensation that they sent it around the country. And that was the beginning of the Hearst-Seelig newsreel. And then he was gained immortality of a sort by being the producer of The Perils of Pauline, which was
Pearl White.
Pearl White, yes. Oh, and he produced that. Now, of course, there was a method in this madness. He had a great feeling for the masses. And incidentally, it might be nice here to mention it. Mr. Hearst got credit for being a yellow journalist and all that. But as you look, which I did a great deal of research about his papers, he was for the common man, no matter how you look at it, he was. No one could ever accuse him of using his papers as an instrument to further solidify the big business. That's one thing that he never was accused of. I mean, he tried. Now, probably there was an ulterior motive or another motive, the fact that he wanted a successful paper. But nevertheless, the end result was for the masses. He wrote for the masses. He tried to. He had his finger on the mass mind. Well, he was one of the great journalists of all time. You see. But anyway, The Perils of Pauline, he produced that as a serial. But, you see, again, simultaneously, he released the episodes in his newspaper every week, the same ones that you were going to see Saturday night.
Do you recall how many different serials there were of Pauline? Was it just one package, or did she have a...
Well, what do you mean about one package?
Well, let's say 15 chapters made a complete story. Did he have three 15-chapter sets, or was it just the one?
In my recollection, it was 15 or 16, whatever it was.
And that was it.
Or maybe 20 chapters. Uh-huh. That's right. Uh-huh. Yes. And then, of course, he went in very seriously with Adolf Zucker in the feature pictures, built his own studio, Cosmopolitan, and he had it from 1919 to about 1937, 38, 39, something. About 20 years, I guess he had it.
And he produced a lot of
films. Oh, very dear, he produced. But they never were. The overall, the end result was that he lost millions of dollars because his flair for lavishness made it so that he never had any thought of an adequate return for what he was laying out. The other men took budgets and things like that, but he didn't. If he say, go ahead, let's do it, let's shoot the whole boat, let's shoot the fleet, or whatever it was. And they were very lavish and got good notices, a great many of them, you know. But the end result was that he lost, $7 million in 20 years or whatever it was, which was a lot of money in those days. And there's an interesting thing, too, that I mentioned in the book about this English financier up at San Simeon once asking him, he said, Mr. Hearst, he said, is there any money in motion pictures? And Mr. Hearst said, well, there's a lot of mine in there. So at least he had a sense of humor about it.
Well, he had a lot of money, and he was willing to put it in these things, and I think he enjoyed seeing it spent. On back to San Simeon for a second, the story in your book, The Golden Days of San Simeon, you mention about this gigantic swimming pool. He had it all finished, and then he said it wasn't big enough.
It was San Simeon. That's right. He changed it twice. Changed it twice, and enlarged it to the way it is today.
Is that the part where I love the line? It was great. It talks about how he was willing to spend his money for this thing. Somebody said, "You realize what that'll cost?" And he said, "Well, it'll put some people to work."
Yes, he did. He actually said that. He said to Nigel Keith, his gardener, he said, do you realize this is going to cost another couple of million dollars? And he said, good, it was during Depression, and he said it'll give a lot of unemployed people work. Yeah. And, you're speaking about it while you're on the subject of the money and spending. You see, many, as we said before, many millionaires had more money than Hearst, and most of them exercised more wisdom in using it. But none of them enjoyed their wealth as much as Mr. Hearst. And that was because he had a great philosophy about money. He considered it merely something to spend. Now, considering that the temptation to spend money for things we want and don't really need, and considering the brevity of life itself, maybe Mr. Hearst exercised a certain kind of wisdom in enjoying his wealth.
Well, he had the wealth to enjoy. That was
he did.
That was
but,
it.
But by the same token, he really had a feeling, something unchangeably democratic about him, and it wasn't opposed. You see, when that land, for instance, was bought by his father, it started with 40,000 acres, 70 cents an acre. His father bought, And his father used it to go up there to take his son, an only son, mm-hmm. which was William Randolph, mm-hmm. and the wife, Phoebe, who he adored, who was a wonderful woman. Three of them go to camping. And then when Mr. Hearst got a family of his own, mm-hmm. he took his sons up there. And it started to take on the same feeling of San Simeon. Of course, all tents. But there was one big tent, and there were three little tents around the side, and there were tents for the thing. And he ran, that's where he first ran movies, on a sheet, you know, mm-hmm. The early Chaplin movies and stuff that he got a projector and he'd run these movies. It was sort of an extension of his love of those picnicking days, that the one thing that everybody mentions, and I have it in the book, a picture of it, as a matter of fact, on Christmas Eve, you can see mm-hmm. it, that with the blue willow china and the Sheffield silver and the priceless dandy chairs and this old oaken table and all that, cost all the money, yet all condiments were in their original containers.
Mustard, ketchup and mustard and pickle lily.
And that was kind uh-huh. of a carryover from the days. I think he was trying to hold on to those.
Well, he actually called it the ranch, didn't he?
He always called it the ranch. He never called it the castle. Uh-huh. He called it the ranch, yeah.
And around that table, we'd find Cary Grant and Clark Gable and Ken
George
Murray.
George Bernard Shaw and President Coolidge and his wife and the great names of that period from all over the world, you know, it was an exciting time. And I remember sitting across the table, which I was privileged to do. Now, don't get the idea, Chuck, that I was his bunk buddy and I was there all the time. But I was there, and I visited there many times, but not as much as I would have liked to, mm-hmm. because I had blackouts during the thing, and that ran every night. You see, three shows on Sunday, two on Saturday, 3,844 performances, 7.5 years. So I didn't get a chance to really go as much. In those days, I went down to the beach house, which he had down there, and I occasionally went down there. But it was like Hedda Hopper said, never, never land. Never has there been such a place, and never will we see its likes again. And I'm so glad that younger people, and I'm not just throwing a bone to the younger mm-hmm. or trying to ingratiate myself to the younger set, but I'm so glad that he made contact with him, because it would have pleased him, I'm sure. It would have pleased him, because he always liked young people around him. He always liked not only starlets, mm-hmm. but young mm-hmm. men and actors and, gosh, many of them. And he didn't invite, I'll tell you another thing, you know the fact that Ken Murray was there, that he did not invite him for just their current success uh-huh. or their fame, he wanted, and I hope I put myself in that category, but I don't mean it that way, but he liked people that were likable and diverting. He liked to have fun. He liked the place to be gay. And he liked people to laugh. And he liked them to get outdoors. And he liked them to play tennis. And he fixed picnics. And a sort of living that in this fast, nervous age, we just don't take much time out for. Of course, that isn't really so, because when you look at the amount of people who do take time off and go all over the country or all over the world today, I guess traveling is the biggest hobby that anyone has outside of amateur photography. I know that the castle is doing tremendous. 100,000 people more this year than last year. And they're very nice about giving me credit for the film. Probably making some of the being responsible for some of the increase, but there's an awful lot of people traveling these days. And another thing that Mr. Hearst would like, because he liked to travel.
Exactly. Where is the castle located?
Well, it's just about halfway between Los Angeles and San Francisco. It's 248 miles from Los Angeles. And you drive up the coast highway. It's a beautiful mm-hmm. drive. And then at San Luis Obispo, you follow route number one, which was the original route. And it's about 40 miles from San Luis Obispo. And it's an exciting place that even today, because you look up and you can see the castle. You see, in the golden days of San Simeon, the people, the visitors could only see the castle from a coin in a slot telescope 5 miles away. But now they of course are much more fortunate, you know. Mm-hmm. But not only can you go on go into San Simeon and go up on one of the balconies up on the second floor, for instance, and any way that you look, Mr. Hearst owned all, in every direction, including 50 miles of ocean shoreline of the Pacific Ocean.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
That's great. Can you spend a day up there? If you get out there, can you spend the whole day in there?
More than one day. They have about 3 tours. Uh-huh. And you have to make reservations, and you have to be sure that ahead of time. You see, most people drive up, and they stay overnight, have to stay overnight, and they make their reservation the day before, and then they go there. But if it's the busy season, which is, well, obviously from about May till October, mm-hmm. there's 5,000 people a day going through there.
Wow.
5,000 people a day. But, Chuck, if you ever come up there, you mentioned it to me. You be sure and get in touch with me. I'll give you the home before I leave. No, and I'll fix it so you'll be able to go through, because after all, we're all Hollywood buffs, and I mean, we got to stick together, don't we?
Right. Ken Murray, can we talk a little bit about the golden age of Ken Murray's Hollywood?
Well, you have
a couple of minutes yet?
Oh, you bet. We've got plenty of time.
We'll take a break, and we'll be back with Ken Murray, author of a beautiful new book called The Golden Days of San Simeon, and we're going to talk a little bit about the great days of Hollywood. We're back again with our guest Ken Murray, author of a great new book called The Golden Days of San Simeon. And we're going to talk now with Ken Murray about the golden days of Ken Murray's Hollywood. Ken, you came to Hollywood after being a success in vaudeville and on the Broadway stage. Didn't you? You were telling me before that you worked with Bob Hope.
Bob Hope. As a matter of fact, he used to be my understudy in vaudeville. Bob wouldn't mind because I kid him about it all the time. But he was a master of ceremonies in Newark when I was a headliner at the Palace. And we're both the same age, by the way. We don't let him get away. Because every time he has a birthday, I send him a letter and I say, boy, or a wire or something. I say, boy, I tell you, I just hope I look as good as you when I get to be your age. And he says, oh, come on, you're Sophie Tucker's father. But vaudeville was the first thing. That's what brought me to the coast the mm-hmm. first time, and it was that vaudeville trip that made possible, gave me the idea to take the movies to send home to the folks, you know.
You didn't want to
send postcards
write card,
and snapshot.
Huh?
I hate to write.
Boy, that was the best decision you ever made, I think, to preserve something.
And Chuck, I'll tell you something very interesting about that, though, that you, you know, there was no thought of any commercial mm-hmm. value at that time. But there couldn't be. There couldn't be, because you see, in those days, up until the 50s, every studio that had a star on the contract, they had the exclusive use of their voice and face, and mm-hmm. no one, even if the star wanted to give it to you, no one could use it commercially. And it wasn't until the star system, the studios disbanded, that I was able to go to each one of the people that I had taken pictures of, 248 of them.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody, and they were so wonderful. One girl, a big star, she refused, and that's all out of 248. And the reason she refused is that I used to go around with her. She's a very big star, you'd recognize, but I'm not going to mention her name for only one reason, is that I don't want her to feel, or I don't want anybody to feel, that when I'm asking somebody to let me use their film for nothing, you understand, that I'm angry because they don't do it, because why should they do it? However, it isn't exactly for nothing, because every time I do one of these shows, I always give the Motion Picture Relief Fund. I gave them $10,000 when I did the first special in the name of all those people, you know? But this girl, I called her and I said, I've got that stuff that we took in the backyard. Do you mind? And this is a big star. This is one of the biggest stars of the 40s. And so she said, yo, that's all right, I understand that. Sure, you go ahead and use it, Ken. So I said, well, look, I'm going to New York, I'm going on a Como show, and the lawyers want actual in writing, and so I'm getting it in writing from everybody. So I said, would you send me a wire? And so the next morning I got the wire, and she said, dear Ken, She said, I thought it over, and I wish you wouldn't use it, because my husband is angry, gets angry and upset for every time that I mention anybody that I ever went around with or anything, you know. And her husband was a big star, but he, I guess, I don't know why it was. But anyway, I said, oh, well, forget about it. Listen, forget. And I never did use it. I got some great pictures and some beautiful pictures in bathing suits. And so you'll have to use your own imagination.
Well, we'll come over to your house sometime and watch your own unreleased home movies. That ought to be gay. Your first film was in 1929, your first role on the screen.
Yeah.
Am I right? Half Marriage?
Half Marriage. I had a row of biggies in those days. Oh, I'd tell you, Half Marriage with Olive Borden. Does that shake you up?
Olive Borden.
Ladies of the Jury with Edna Mae Oliver. However, Leathernecking, I did make a picture, which was Irene Dunne's first picture.
1930.
And the funny part of it all was is that at that time I was singing on the stage and making records, as a matter of fact. And Irene Dunne came from Showboat as a singer. And when the picture was released, she had a song in it, and I had a song, and they left mine in and took hers out, you know. And I never always forget her coming out of San Bernardino, out of the preview, with this big hat at that time, one of these floppy hats, you know, crying, you know. It was her first picture, you know, and she'd just come out from Showboat here in Chicago. That's where they got her. She was playing the lead in Showboat. But she went ahead, she overcame it.
She did a pretty decent job.
Yes, sir. She did a mighty fine, stylish job.
We had a chance to chat with her one afternoon on Those Were the Days, too.
And you know what she always says to me? Don't you mention that first picture. She always says, so I had a book a couple of years ago, about 10 years ago, and I put the picture in. She says, oh, she wants to forget that one.
Before you mentioned your tremendous hit, Blackouts, which ran for 7 years or something.
Seven and a half years.
Was that at the El Capitan Theater?
El Capitan, yeah.
I can often remember a lot of the big-time radio programs were broadcast from there, too.
Well,
Bob Hope, as a matter of fact, I've heard a show where he said, broadcasting from the El Capitan Theater.
Well, I was there at the time.
Were you?
Home of Ken Murray's
Blackout. Ken Murray's
Blackout. Yeah, well, I was there at the time, yeah. I did a lot of shows with him at that time, yeah. Yeah, that wasn't the main one before that. You see, we were in the 40s. Mm-hmm. The radio was starting to show its age at that time.
Mm-hmm.
But in the 30s, we had two other places. One was a Lux Theater, which was opposite the Brown Derby on Vine Street, and the other one was a Guild Theater down the street. And as a matter of fact, I was very fortunate. My wife, that's where I met her in Blackout. She came in to do a dramatic scene with me. And she worked in those other radio theaters a lot. She worked with Orson Welles.
Uh-huh.
And she also
I got
worked
another
with
interview going.
Frank Sinatra, too. Uh-huh. But in the early days not the early days of radio, but in the last days of radio.
You said the Guild Theater and the Lux Theater. Those weren't the actual names of the theaters that the programs were on, you know, the Lux Radio Theater.
Lux Radio Theater.
Had their own theater?
Yes. No. But the Guild Theater was the name of a movie house.
Oh, I see.
But the Lux Theater, I guess they didn't call it the Lux Theater, really. What was it, honey?
I think it was just CBS
Playhouse. It got to be the CBS Playhouse. Uh-huh. But there was something before that, too. Uh-huh. Just like the El Capitan was something before I moved in Blackouts.
Then, besides discovering your wife in Blackouts, you discovered Marie Wilson?
Yeah, well, I didn't discover Marie Wilson. She had made a picture in 35 called Boy Meets Girl.
Uh-huh.
And on one of the radio shows that I had that I told you about, where I had the stooge that went, Oswald. We had many guests on there. And one of them was Marie Wilson. And I always remembered that I've got a very strong feeling about comedians. And I don't care if the rest of them are listening. But there are certain people that I can't stand. I don't like comedians as a rule. There's something that repels inside of me. There's something almost revolting about a woman when she becomes mannish. I hate it.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so the only kind of comedian that I like is somebody that I can laugh at and still want to have a date with.
Uh-huh.
That's my motto. If I can look, Lucille Ball all through the years, yes, I knew her and I could understand. I could understand. But the minute they get to the point of where they get mannish or where they get broad or where they get hokey, then something happens. I just feel that they're losing part of
it. You don't want them to lose their femininity, then?
Not at all. Yeah. Not at all. Who? So Marie, anyway, worked with me, and I remembered that this funny girl, and yet very attractive. So when I opened Black House, I contacted her, and she wasn't doing anything then. She had a picture thing was sagging a little bit, and so... but she went into Black Ops and she got rejuvenated and got to Irma, and she was off to the races for a few years again.
Did she stay with Black Ops for almost the entire
Yeah, she stayed for the pretty near to the end, but Cy Howard, the guy that produced My Friend Irma, you know, boy, it was contemptible. I was really angry. We're friends now, but I was really angry about that. They came in for 6 months. He admitted it with his writers. And the character that, let us say, we had created for Marie, we had created. I mean, you can't make a girl like that unless she is, but you can give her the opportunity to do it. They adapted it to Irma. That's all it was. Same thing that I did that. So, and we're going along, and we're doing capacity business, you know. We did close to $1 million a year. And she was the leading lady, and we did $6 million. We grossed over 5.5 million people. So we're in about the fifth year or the sixth year, and she came over and said to me, I've got a chance for a radio show. I said, well, good luck, you know. And she gets on the show, and that hits, Irma hits. And then this guy, which I really still feel very strongly about, gives it out to the paper that she's leaving. She's leaving Black House. Well, I had a 7-year contract, and I had lived up to every inch of it, as a matter of fact, more so, by giving bonuses every year. Not tremendous, you know, but bonuses. I'll let you know, pat it on the head like a dog, like a dog does a trick, you pat him on the head, you know. Or a child, you let him know. Well, anyway, he gives a story out. Well, I went to Jerry Geisler, and I said, I want to make trouble for this man. I want to make trouble. This is the contemptible, because I helped him in every way. I was courageous and everything, and I hated him. I hated him. So, the point is that he felt, you see, that the fact she was in Irma was helping the show now, you see, and that's why we were continuing on into the fifth and sixth and seventh year, you see, and it made me mad, because that wasn't the truth, because when Marie went out finally, I put an understudy in, and we still did capacity business, didn't make any difference, because the momentum was so great, but boy, it made me mad. So anyway, we slapped the suit, you see, right away. And our basis of the suit was that we had got some calls and some cancellations, one or two, you know, that said, I understand Marie Wilson's not in the show anymore. And we needed that like we needed a hole in the head. Why should we be subjected to that at all? Didn't do anything. I'm living up to my contract. So anyway, we sued him, and we sued Lever Brothers. Well, I tell you, such excitement you never saw. Lever Brothers got on the phone. The guys came with the pinstripe suits with the briefcases. I said, for every penny that Lever Brothers has got, he said, now let's work it out. Let's work it out. We can work it out some way. I said, you have damaged them, you know. Well, of course, you see, actually, I couldn't do a thing, because we still did capacity business and we still went along. So all they did was sit back for about 3 or 4 months and said, well, now look, Ken, you haven't lost anything, there's no momentum, and she's not going to do anything. Put a retraction in the paper, and it just made me angry, that's all. And I'm angry as I think of it now, I guess you get that.
Well, I didn't mean to get you all excited today.
Well, I'm glad you brought it up, great. Chuck. I haven't been angry like that for a while.
Did anyone else emerge from Blackouts as a star that we would recognize?
Well, sure. For one thing, I had a fellow in it. Billy Gilbert was in it when it opened for a few weeks. I don't mean that he was discovered. Mm. But then he went out, he had a picture to make, and they brought a fellow in with a drum. Babaloo, Babaloo, Desi Arnaz.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, and he was in it for a long time. Uh-huh. And then we had a lot of other kinds of people. For instance, we had a chorus girl that I gave some bits to, very attractive, you could understand why, she was very good, Rhonda Fleming. She was a chorus girl in Blackouts when it opened. Mm-hmm. Then there was a little Western group, you know, with a guitar, and Dinky Stewart, I think her name was, and in there was a girl playing the guitar. It was Mary Ford, Les Paul and Mary Ford.
Yeah.
And it went on, and of course I discovered my wife, which was the most important discovery in the world, Betty Lou.
John Garrett.
Who?
John Garrett.
Oh, yes, I forgot that too. We had a boy that had a Hopper call me up and said, you got to hear this boy, he's fine. So I put this boy in, and he was great. He had a tenor voice. And one night his voice changed on the stage. He was singing, When I'm Resigned and Smart, and the winner, Early. And I fired him, and it was John Gary, and he still tells
John Gary.
Story. John Gary, yeah.
My goodness. Well, you really, you discovered a lot of people. You produced some interesting things, too, in Hollywood. Back to the screen business now. You produced and narrated an exciting animated feature about...
Not animated, real. Real
That's
bird.
Right, it wasn't animated.
Did you ever see it?
I'm correct. Of course, sure.
You did?
Harry Davenport had a role in that, didn't he? The elderly screen actor, No.
This was all birds, the thing is. This was all birds. This was the first animal picture ever made.
Bill and Coo, we're talking
Bill and
about.
Coo. This was made before Disney made any of his animal pictures. Mm-hmm. Matter of fact, Disney saw this at Edgar Bergen's house and just kidded about it. He said, well, why draw them when you can shoot them live? Just kidding about it. But he did, and no way copied it, because he went into the educational type of, left the animals in their own habitat, where I did a fictional story. What I tried to do, the birds were in the show, 14 birds, they were parakeets, each one an inch and a half high, have a teaspoonful of blood in them, and every night I would watch them, and they became little people. They do these fantastic tricks, and he talked to them, and that's the way he trained them. He talked to them, and I thought, if it's little people, you can write a story about them. So I wrote the story of Bill and Coo. Now what I did is I wrote a story that that people could play. God forbid nobody would do the picture with this lighter story, but people could play it. There was a boy that was a taxi driver, and his mother took in washing. She was poor, and he was in love with a girl who her father owned the biggest hotel in town. And then we had a heavy that was a raven, a crow, and he flew over the town, and I simulated that with bombing, with the aeroplanes, you see. And then they had a big circus, and they all do the tricks, and then the crow catches all the town in the tent, and so Bill sneaks out, draws them away, and they capture the world. Now, this is a story of a fella and a girl, you know. So I thought, wouldn't it be funny write a regular story and have birds play it? So that's it. So we got a Special Academy Award.
Yeah, 1947.
Yeah.
I remember one thing about the movie. It was in color. Yet it wasn't. It wasn't the
wasn't
color
the
we
color.
Were used to
no,
seeing
no,
on
no.
the screen.
Well, see, what happened was. Another wild idea. Another wild idea of make a picture with birds. I'll never forget when I went into the... See, we were doing $1 million a year. We had very good credit in the bank, say, you know, blackouts. So I went into the Bank of America and Ivar and Wilcox, rather, and Hollywood Boulevard. And I went in and I thought, I've got to get some money for this thing. It's going to cost, you know, about... Well, it ultimately cost about $700,000. On account of shooting all day, and you never knew the birds would do the trick. They fly up on a ceiling, and it costs money. So anyway, I went in to get the money for it, you know, finally went to get the finance. So I walked into the bank, and I'll never forget. Walked into the bank, and I said, I'd like to get some money for a picture. He said, Joe, can you come out right here? I said, right there, you're going to make a picture. You and Marie, huh? You're going to do blackouts? Oh, man, I got to see that. I said, no, this is a different kind of picture. This is a picture about birds. He said, birds? The birds? He says, who's in it? Well, who plays the lead? I said, well, a bird. A bird plays the lead, and then there's a female bird, and then a crow. He said, what's the heavy? I said, a crow. He said, a crow. He said, how many birds? I said, 300. He said, 300 birds. And he said, yeah. He said, that's... And you're not in it? I said, no, I'm going to narrate it. He said, Marie's not in it? I said, no. He said, yeah, well, I said, how much money you need? I said, well, I guess you're going to have at least $500,000. I said, yes, indeed. He said, yeah, that's fine. He said, and he got up. You know, do you ever have anybody usher you out and you felt you were being ushered out, but they don't touch you? He just got up, and I got up, and he put his arm around me, and we walked out, and he says, Ken, you know something? You've been working hard, you know that. He said, you ought to take a little rest. You really should take a little rest, a little vacation. He said, life is not worth the thing. So I said, When I look at, what about this thing? He said, yeah, well, I got to take it up with the board. He says, birds, huh? 300 birds, he said, yeah. Well, I'll get back to you, you know. Well, up to this moment, he never got back to it. And, of course, it was a terribly hard thing to shoot because we had the olive birds and you take a bird and put it down, you see, and did you ever see Bill and Cooey, either one of you ever see? Well, these are some friends of ours sitting here, but the point is that here's a picture that was a feature picture, and every move, every move was a trick. If you want the bird to walk into a tent and sit down up on a seat, it was a trick, a separate trick. So therefore, it took 8 months to shoot. And while you didn't have to pay any actors, you had to pay the crews. And sometimes you start at 9 o'clock in the morning, and at 3 and 5 the next morning, you still were not maybe a half a minute of the picture because the bird wasn't working. What do you say to them? Come on, kids, let's go. We're behind. You know, they didn't care. They flew up in the ceiling.
Has the film been released for television?
Oh, sure. Listen, that is the most interesting thing. It's 24 years old. Metromedia bought it. It played in Chicago here not too long ago, I think. Metromedia bought it for 6 stations for 7 years. And Paramount took it for the rest of the country and foreign. And that's in 26 foreign countries now. And right now, when I get back to Coast, I'm just concluding a deal where they're going to run it on Saturday and Sunday in the theaters for those kid matinees.
Oh, great.
Yeah, they're going to run it on Saturday and Sunday here in the United States. And then they took it for foreign again. It was very big foreign. It was very big, like South America and Africa and India. Very big. And it's understandable because the birds were on the trees. The birds are on a tree, like our sparrows. They have parakeets, and they take them home and they teach them tricks. See, and when they saw these fantastic tricks, oh, you never saw anything like it. We got one trick in a circus where two rings, and the bird gets on and grabs the two rings with the two, and then does it constantly a flip like this by themselves.
No kidding.
By themselves. I mean, never wire them on. Nothing tricky in the whole picture, you know. I put a big orchestra. I got the whole Fox thing, the Newman Bunch, Dave Butov, and did a whole 50-piece orchestra, 30 voices. Because I was afraid, you see, when you did a bird picture, I was afraid, you know, brand new, nobody ever done that, and I was afraid that a fair bird picture, we might be in trouble, you know, so it had to be a good one we might get in trouble with, you know. So I went first class all the way. But anyway, I couldn't get a release. Technicolor said, look, I'll give you a release. I'll give you the Technicolor prints, the Calmus. He said, but you've got to get a release through one of these companies. And it was 5 companies, the major ones. And they all said that they couldn't see that you could make a feature out of it. So I went to Republic, who had his own color, Yates. And he gave me a release, you see, if I use his color. But I also shot it at the same time with another camera. That's why it cost so much. Every shot with the same camera, 16, and that's the one we're using on television today.
And that is
Kodachrome. That's Kodachrome. That's 3. I figured at the time the other was a 2-color process, and Technicolor was in, and I figured, well, it's not going to go back to 2 colors, so I better for some future time have it, because I knew it was going to last. And I purposely didn't go to RKO because Disney was there, and I figured that they're not going to push it for an award, and I thought it had a chance. Just like I feel, I know people think I'm crazy. I think that the golden days of San Simeon. I think this book is going to be, and I'll go on record, and even though it'll be a jerk in 5 years, it'll be one of the all-time steady sellers. All-time steady sellers in the book business. Because, and gosh, it's not even a guess. You got 700,000 people every year that take the trouble to drive their car, go up and stay overnight, and pay money to see the tour, to walk through a building. Now, you're going to have a certain percentage of 700,000, and say you only get 5%. That'll be only 35,000 books a year, which is, I don't want to get into it, because it's frightening.
Well, I suggest that anybody who is even remotely interested in this go to one of the major bookstores in the Chicago area, get a copy of it, and spend 2 minutes flipping through the pages, and you'll be hooked on it. It's great. Everything you've described about San Simeon today is in the book. that fantastic dining area there with the giant fireplace. You could walk into that fireplace.
Yes, yes. Three people could walk in.
Yeah.
They had to ultimately close that because it was so hot. The fire, Mr. Hirsch loves the fireplace. He had them all. He got 47 of them in the castle. But it was so hot that the people would be burned on one side, roasted on one side, so they had to put glass around.
They had roast guests for dinner.
The roast guests. But you see, that's true. And I also have a very good publisher, which I'm very happy. You know, very good distribution. They got them all around. They never run out of the books. You know, like some of the smaller publishers, they have trouble that they don't get the books in the stores, you know. But this one here, Doubleday, I tell you, it is just great. And they have, the books are in all the stores, and Christmas time for a Christmas gift, don't you think?
Oh, great. Absolutely. Yeah.
And you see, the book tells the building of it and how it was as a guest. I even described from the time I got my invitation to getting on the train and going up there, and the parties, over 110 pictures of movie stars, and then a tour as it is today, you know.
So I went with you. When I read the book, I went with you on your visit to San Simeon.
Now, tell the truth, Chuck. Did the book make you want to see San Simeon?
Absolutely.
Yeah?
Sure.
Well,
oh, no question about it.
I'll tell the Doubleday about it. They won't believe me because we've got some very rough people there. But Wally and Ellie and Ken McCall.
One last thing. We didn't even get a chance to talk about television and the wide open spaces and Anheuser-Busch and all of that stuff, but maybe we'll do that another time. But Ken Murray, you said something about taking all the movies and sending them home in lieu of postcards back home, but what about the people you were photographing? Charlie Chaplin and Clark Gable and William Randolph Hearst. Yeah. They were willing subjects for you, weren't they?
Yeah, well, I explained to you. They were. Yeah. They you see, actually, Chuck, this is something that nobody has to discover. The most flattering thing you can say to anyone is, may I take your picture? I don't care whether it's a movie star or what it is. Now, they might be, a woman might not have her hair fixed. I remember Greer Garson came out of a pool once, and I said, I was there at Palm Springs. I said, Greer, I'm not going to take a picture of you because your hair. She said, thank you. And or Fred Astaire is on a golf course without his toupee, or Bing without his toupee. No, I don't do that. You understand? Uh-huh. But otherwise, the most flattering thing, may I take your picture? Now, you see, when you say, well, yeah, but was it? But were they satisfied to do it commercially, you know? Mm-hmm. But there was no thought of that.
Nothing at that time.
There was
time,
no thought. And even if they did think of it, it was a usual thing for newsreels to come and take pictures in formal shots. So you were the same thing, only I didn't have a newsreel badge on, you know?
Well, we're glad that you took all those films and preserved a lot of those memories, and we're glad to have you share them with all of us who delight in those golden days of Hollywood.
Chuck, may I say something? I'd like to say a couple of words on Hollywood before I go.
Be my guest.
That I am terrible, because this being this kind of a show, I am terribly disturbed, distressed, with the attitude of Hollywood about pictures today. Now, this is all over, permeating all over the town. You know, the big studios are gone. And we now look back on account of the age of permissiveness, which I think is actually witnessing a decline in good taste all in the name of realism. And people forget that beauty is realistic, too. They discover it once in a while, like in Sound of Music, or a modern-day version of one of the pictures that would have been made before, Love Story, with some language that makes it modern. But Hollywood has a tendency today to look back at its pre-message pictures, like a reformed convict looks back on his crimes. Something like Crazy Otto up in the attic, you know. We shouldn't talk about him, you know, and don't let anybody see him. I think that's sad. I think that's sad because 90 million people a week went to the movies. 20 years ago, 25 years ago from that time, or 20 years ago, but that everybody was a movie fan. 90 people a week went to the movies. And you went to the movies then to be entertained. I go to be entertained. I don't go to learn anything. Mm-hmm. Now, maybe that sounds terrible. Maybe I say, well, that's a trouble thing. You don't want to learn, you know. But I don't go there. I learn on the news. And if I want to have problems, I look at my income tax, you know. No, it's true. I mean, I don't go to the movies to wallow in somebody's problems, mm-hmm. you know, with their problems. Mm-hmm. I don't do that. And as far as the permissiveness is concerned, I think they're going to find, and they are finding out slowly, that sex is not a spectator sport. Mm-hmm. They found out in Myra Breckinridge, they found out in Valley of the Dolls, and there are very good things done. Now, don't misunderstand me, very good pictures made. Fine. But now, the average new filmmaker makes fun of the pictures, the musicals, and all the things, mm-hmm. the trash and the pap, you know. Now, he's not right. He's not right when he does it, and we wouldn't be right if we said that none of these pictures should be made. I'm not for that. Yeah. I'm not for doing, taking them, having none of them. But I think there's room and need for both. And I hope, and I think that everything points to that. I think that the success of Love Story and Sound of Music and those kind of things.
I think that we are going through one of these changes again now, and pretty soon we'll come back to the era of good old-fashioned entertainment.
Yeah, well, I don't think it'll go back to that era, but I mean, I think Love Story mm-hmm. is not going back to that era, but retaining a certain, I don't know, that graceful living or...
Well, an entertaining movie.
That's right. Go back to entertainment.
Yeah. Something that right. tears your sweatshirt while you're sitting in right. the show, right? Ken Murray, we hope all our listeners will share your memories of the golden days of San Simeon, and they will in great abundance when they get a copy of your new book. And thank you very much for being with us today on Those Were the Days.
It was a pleasure, Chuck. And I'm going to send you some things, and be sure that you give me credit on the air for the transcriptions that I send you.
You're letting in on a secret, but I'll give you credit on the air. I'll play one of them.
Okay.
Maybe. Thank you.